Very much. It's great to be back here. I was actually a graduate fellow here at KITP in fall of 2003, and it was actually during that period that this collaboration began when I started working on cosmic superstrings. So this work began with Nick Jones, one of the other students, and with Joe Polchinski, who unfortunately is not here today. So today I'll be discussing a lot of different aspects of cosmic superstrings. And to begin with, I'll discuss cosmic strings in general, just to bring everybody up to speed. And then I'll discuss what cosmic superstrings are and how they differ from the conventional type of cosmic strings. I'll discuss how to detect them, and then most importantly, if we were to detect them, how we would be able to distinguish these two different types of cosmic strings, the usual type and the cosmic superstrings. And then finally, I'll conclude about some work in progress. Now, the whole idea of cosmic strings began when people started studying symmetry breaking in cosmology. Now, you're probably all familiar with symmetry breaking in field theory. As usual, when you have the field which starts at a potential, at a high point in the potential, and it rolls to the minimum, then in cosmology, the situation is a little bit different. Because in cosmology, we often get these event horizons. So the field doesn't know to roll to the same place in the minimum everywhere. And so it will often roll to different places in the minimum. And in space-time, this corresponds to occasionally being able to make a complete loop in space-time, and this corresponds to a loop around the minimum. And if you can track this loop, eventually you'll get to a point where the field has to be sitting still on the top of the potential, and this gives you a little core of energy, and if you extend this out in the third dimension, this gives you a cosmic string, a little filament of energy. Now, of course, once these cosmic strings form, they don't just sit there. They're dynamic objects, and they wiggle around, and they reconnect. And so we often get these cosmic string networks. So this is what it would look like at the formation of these cosmic strings. And this is what it looks like after you allow these cosmic strings to evolve a little bit. And you see that you get a few cosmic strings stretching from one end of the horizon to the other. And then you often get these little bits of loops, which are quickly decaying as they smash into each other. Now, when people talk about cosmic string networks, the most important parameter by far is this parameter g mu. So this is a dimensionless parameter in four dimensions. So in this g mu, g is the usual Newton gravitational constant, and mu is the string tension. And it's often around the same scale as the phase transition at which these cosmic strings formed. So as I said, it's dimensionless. Now, For a gut string, we know that the temperature is about 10 to the 15. That's around where we would expect a phase transition to happen. And so if we stick in the typical Planck mass, we expect g mu to be around 10 to the minus 6. Now, this is really important because it was realized early on that it was exactly around this scale that cosmic strings would be able to produce structure in the universe. If these cosmic strings formed and then moved around and wiggled a little bit, the perturbations that it would create could be responsible for galaxies and everything that we see here today. And so this was an early competitor with inflationary theory, but they make vastly different predictions in terms of the power spectrum. And so it was only a few years ago when more precise measurements of the power spectrum were performed that that cosmic strings could be dismissed as the major component of structure formation. Now, I want to be clear on this point. This doesn't mean that cosmic strings can't exist. It just means they've been found to not be the dominant form of structure formation. They could exist in minute amounts. And of course, when you run through the simulations and you allow the possibility that such a minute amount of cosmic string exists in the universe, there's actually a better fit when you allow about 11% of the structure to be from cosmic strings. So it turns out when you sample over all the parameters, the system prefers to have a little bit of cosmic string in there. And recently, there's been some speculation that some people have almost even claimed that there must be cosmic strings there. Because if you'll notice, even though the power spectrum for cosmic strings is very flat over most of the range, whereas inflation gives a huge peak over here, cosmic strings actually dominate the power at very large L. So at very small scales, cosmic strings actually give a larger contribution than inflation. And there have been some experiments which actually show a little bit of excess power at very small scales, at large L. And so there's been speculation over whether this could be interpreted as some sort of evidence for cosmic strings, but better measurements have to be performed before we can say anything definitely. Now, if we can get cosmic strings from field theory, it would kind of a natural idea that we should be able to get cosmic strings from string theory. And this idea was both proposed and dismissed by Witten in the same article in 1985. And the reason it was dismissed was that back then, there was no mechanism to produce these cosmic strings. There was no sort of inflationary theory which would account for the symmetry breaking. And so it wasn't clear how these cosmic strings would form in the early universe. Even if they did form, there were arguments that they would quickly decay. They were not stable from instanton effects. The natural Planck scale was much, much larger than we would expect. It was very clear that these cosmic strings could not actually exist. And even if you ignore those three arguments that I just mentioned, it wasn't clear how these cosmic superstrings would be any different from the usual type of cosmic strings. So there's no way that we should glorify them by calling them cosmic superstrings if they would seem to behave identically to the usual type of gauge vortex strings. But this was about 20 years ago, and we've learned a lot about string theory in those 20 years. And so the subject was recently revisited with non-perturbative knowledge by Copeland, Myers, and Polchinski in 2003. And they found ways, which are very model-dependent, I want to emphasize, but they did find ways of overcoming each of these problems that I've just mentioned. And so now, with non-perturbative string theory, we found ways that we can produce cosmic superstrings somewhat naturally. They're not there all the time, but we can get them in a lot of the models. So to be clear about what I'm talking about when I talk about cosmic superstrings, so the basic type is the so-called F-string, the fundamental string in string theory. It's just much larger than the usual point particle type of strings that we talk about. So it has the usual tension, naively on the order of the Planck scale, and they're just really big. And these are already there in the perturbative spectrum whenever you compactify. These are called the winding modes. So you can just imagine that there's a really long string made of the same stuff as the small strings, just much larger. Now, in non-perturbative string theory, there's also these solid tonic objects called D-brains. And it could just so happen that you have a one-dimensional D-brain called the D-string. And so this would also be a candidate for a cosmic superstring. But its tension would have a 1 over G in front, where G is the string coupling. And so we would expect it to have a much larger tension. And then there's even a third type, when you combine those F and D strings, and you get so-called PQ strings. So this is when you take P numbers of F strings and Q D strings, and they'll form a bound state, and it's energetically favorable for it to do this, as you can see from the PQ spectrum. And so we would expect to see this complicated network. Anytime that we saw F strings and we saw D strings, we would expect them to form into these junctions and form PQ networks. And these should be very easy to identify because the tensions at each node in junction should add up according to this formula. Now, the mechanism to produce these cosmic superstrings has been specified according, is best defined according to this KKLMMT model, based on the acronym from the authors, in which we have D brains, which are attracted to each other from electrostatic attraction. So we have a D brain and an anti-D brain. So they're attracted to each other, and they move towards each other in this so-called throat. So this throat has a warp factor, which is much less than unity and acts as a sort of potential, which brings the effective 4D string tension much lower than you would expect. So if this brain inflation process happens in the throat, it would produce cosmic strings, both FD and PQ, and produce tensions much lower than we would expect. So if we were able to produce these cosmic strings, how would we go about trying to actually detect them? So the most obvious way is from gravitational radiation. So this happens naturally as the string moves around about once per period. It will form this cusp. So this is when the Fourier modes conspire to form a cusp like that, and it emits this very focused, sharp burst of gravitational radiation. So if you happen to be lucky and you have a gravitational wave detector in the field of where this burst is headed, you should be able to detect this. So this is the primary signature from gravitational radiation. The secondary signal is from these so-called kinks. Now, as I'll talk about more in detail later, the kinks arise when the strings fly towards each other and they reconnect, and they form this kink-like pattern upon the reconnection. And so when this happens, we get this fan-like pattern of gravitational radiation, so it's more diffuse. So the signal is not as strong, and so we wouldn't expect to see this as much. Now, how would we actually go about trying to calculate such gravitational radiation from cosmic strings? Well, it's actually pretty straightforward. We know that the graviton is really just the coupling to the metric. So we would take the world sheet action for the cosmic strings, and we would just Fourier transform this and see how it couples to the metric. And so this should be the energy momentum tensor for a graviton of wave number k. And so we just take this expression, and we plug in the trajectory of the string for x, and it usually has a saddle point, and so we just perform this, and you can easily see that this is largest for cups and kinks, as we would expect. Now, this is for the classical gauge vortex type of cosmic string. How would we expect this to be changed for a cosmic superstring? Now, remember, cosmic superstrings are quantum objects, so x is actually a field, not just a classical number that we could plug in. So we would expect that it would be basically the same process, basically the same world sheet action, but that there would be quantum corrections to this.
And,
naively you would just say, okay, there would be alpha prime corrections corresponding to quantum corrections because x is a field, fluctuating on the order of alpha prime. So you would expect, you would just go ahead and calculate those. But it's actually not that difficult because by definition, those corrections have to vanish. Superstring theory is defined to be the point at which these quantum corrections on the world sheet vanish. And to be clear on this point, I'm not saying that the space-time effect of action has no quantum corrections. It doesn't, unless there's some sort of supersymmetric reason why those corrections would vanish. I'm talking purely about world sheet corrections. So this is the definition of string theory, when the corrections vanish. So we can actually go ahead and use exactly the same classical action as before. We just figure out what the classical trajectory of the string is doing, what this x field is doing, and then plug it in and look for a saddle point and get an answer. And we can do even better for cosmic superstrings because we don't just have to use the graviton vertex operator. We can go ahead and use any other type of radiation that we would want because in string theory we have all these higher excitation modes. So this is actually really neat that we can now just take this easy process and calculate the radiation for any mode in string theory. Now, it would be kind of exciting because we should be able to see some of these exciting modes. The bad news is that usually these modes are at a pretty high mass scale. So maybe the tension of the string isn't so high as to excite them. But actually, if we're talking about cosmic superstrings in the first place, the tension is usually assumed to be warped down, as I mentioned. So it's actually conceivable that we would be able to see some of these higher modes radiating from cosmic superstrings. Now, this isn't some fanciful pie-in-the-sky idea detecting gravitational radiation from cosmic superstrings. There's already gravitational wave detectors running right now. So the most significant of which is LIGO. So there's two centers for the LIGO experiment. So one is in Washington State and the other is in Louisiana. And they've been running for several years now, and they haven't found any signal, but they're enhancing the technology right now, and so they expect to bring the sensitivity down. There's also Virgo, which is an Italy-based experiment which is running. And then finally, there's plans for a space-based interferometer named LISA, which would have incredible sensitivity and which should be able to detect cosmic strings at basically any tension. So this is the typical probability that we would expect to find a cosmic superstring as a function of the tension, g mu, of this dimensionless parameter. Now, we already know the tension couldn't be in this area. This has already been ruled out. If the tension was really this high, we would have seen them already. So we're kind of interested in sort of this range over here. Now, the reason there are so many lines is because an old analysis by DeMore and Vilenkin had to make a lot of estimates about order one parameters in the detectability computation. And in this recent article, just a year ago, they were able to make more precise estimates for the order one, which unfortunately made the estimate a little bit more pessimistic. So there's two curves that they're doing. So based on the typical values of cosmological data, because this is important for how quickly the universe is expanding, and two different guesses for the sensitivity of the LIGO experiment, both the old LIGO and the new LIGO with better sensitivity, we would expect the probability of detecting a cosmic superstring in 1 year of data to be on the order of 1/100th, which it's not so good, but at least it's plausible, to 1 in 10 to the 4, which is a little bit pessimistic. So this actually isn't so optimistic for finding a cosmic string, if you believe this. But later on, I'll talk about why these numbers might be improved a little bit.
Can you say something about why they're this big flat region in the curve?
Yeah, so you would expect as g mu, as the coupling to gravity gets larger, this would just go up like this, right? Because if it's coupling to gravity, we would expect to be able to see them more. The reason is that because the signal that we get has to be integrated all the way out into space. And so so you have to take into account like what the universe is doing at each point, at each redshift and everything. And so if you make g mu larger, then this affects the overall expansion of the universe a little bit. And so this affects the cosmology and how much we would expect to see from different regions in space. And so the curve does generically go up a bit, and then kind of like this, and then back up. So it's surprising that it's not.
Does that mean we know from other cosmological measurements that g mu is less than something on this?
Well, we know it's not.
We know it's not there.
We know it's not right there. But I don't think we can say anything to the left of that. So all of that was just for gravitational radiation. The second way in which we might see cosmic strings is from gravitational lensing. Now, you're probably all familiar with gravitational lensing from usual astronomical objects. It's a little bit different for a cosmic string because the way that it couples to gravity is it actually creates a conical deficit in the geometry. So this means that it actually doesn't really curve space-time. It actually just removes a section, and then these are to be identified. And so what this means effectively is that if you're here on Earth looking at something, the cosmic string will eat out this wedge in space-time, that the object which is over here behind it actually has two different paths to reach your eye. So everything behind the cosmic string will actually produce two images to your eye. And so this is how we would know that there was a cosmic string. You would never see the cosmic string itself. You would just see two images, two identical images, of whatever's right behind it. And so what people do is they look for two galaxies which are identical and very close together. And this might imply that there was a cosmic string. And it was exactly this case that astronomers found a few years ago, which excited people a lot, the so-called CSL1. And based on the separation of these galaxies, which appeared to be identical and identical distance out, this implied a g mu of about the borderline range. This is a typical g mu of what we would expect. And so people were very excited for a short time. And so we had the Hubble Space Telescope go up and look a little more carefully. And disappointingly, so this is a better image that the Hubble Space Telescope took, you see that they're really not identical. It really was just two galaxies near each other. It wasn't one galaxy lensing. And it's not so unexpected that you would find two galaxies which were similar in the same distance out, because if they're the same distance out, they're the same age, and they're probably made of the same stuff and gravitationally bound to each other. If it had been a cosmic string, we would have seen something like this, the sharp discontinuity between the two. But let's say that it had been a cosmic string, or in some experiment soon, we actually find something which implies that there is a cosmic string. How would we know what type of cosmic string it was, whether it was a gauge vortex type or whether it was a cosmic superstring? Now, the primary way that we would tell is from the reconnection. So as I mentioned briefly a few minutes ago, when cosmic strings fly towards each other, either two things can happen. They can either reconnect into this kink-like pattern where the edges reconnect, or they just fly through each other and absolutely nothing happens and they didn't really ever see each other. So let's say that they reconnect with probability p, meaning they don't reconnect with probability 1 minus p. Now, gauge theory strings, the classical type of cosmic strings, will almost always reconnect. Unless they're at virtually the speed of light, they will always want to reconnect, and so the probability is just 1, regardless of any details of how they were flying towards each other. But for cosmic superstrings, that's not the story at all. For cosmic superstrings, these are actually just two states flying towards each other. It's a scattering problem, so we just work out what the overlap of the wave function is, and we get some sort of matrix element for this. Now that.
Before you go any further, I have to ask my standard question here. So, for this result on gauge theory strings, isn't that the result for, as you say, a classical gauge theory string, or in other words, a weakly coupled gauge theory string? If we had a strongly coupled gauge theory string, do we have any idea what they do?
Good. So this has actually sparked some debate in the industry, because with strongly coupled gauge theories, there might be some sort of dual description or something. And so it's actually not very precise, even though I've sort of explained the situation like, well, there's string theory and there's gauge theory, and the two are completely distinct. It's actually not so distinct. And so people have been looking at duals of this situation. Yeah, so what I talked about here was for weakly coupled. And so people like Dave Tong, I know, has been interested in this. Where they've actually tried to cook up strongly coupled gauge theories, which sort of mimic a string theory thing. And so this might be a precursor to a better understanding. It sort of makes this whole ADS-CFT duality thing, it requires it to be a little more precise. Yeah.
But you can imagine it happening even if there wasn't a string dual, just because of, basically, as you say, if we treat these strings as quantum objects, there should be some probability tunnel through.
Yes. So the precise way that we would calculate the probability to reconnect in string theory is that after we've compactified the six dimensions that we usually compactify, we also take two of our big space dimensions to be big but finite, of size L. And so then we take string winding mode. So this is the usual F string calculation. We take winding modes around those two big dimensions, and they have some skew angle, so it's a parallelogram, and then we say they're flying towards each other in the third direction. Now, just for simplification, we actually usually perform a GSO reversal in this. So this means that we actually can include the tachyons in the spectrum just so that we don't have to worry about polarization factors when we do the calculation. Usually the ground state is projected out, but a single polarization factor is not going to change the result for these huge cosmic strings. And so just to make it a little bit simpler, we usually do this in a type zero theory. So we have these states, and we give them the appropriate momentum and winding numbers to get this. And then we just add up all the different ways in which they could scatter to form a kink. And so at tree level, this is really just the probability for them to do anything, for them to interact at all. And so we can use something very much like the optical theorem to get a final answer for the probability that they will reconnect into anything, because we don't really care exactly which kink configuration they scatter into. We just want to know whether they reconnect or whether they don't. And so we get an answer here which depends very sensitively on the relative angle between the cosmic strings and on the relative velocity that they were flying toward each other. So depending on these different geometric parameters, and depending on of course, this factor of g squared up front, because this is a tree-level probability, we could expect the probability for two F strings to reconnect to be anywhere on the order of 10 to the minus 3 to 1. So kind of small. And of course, this is, as I said, this is only the tree level probability calculation. We would expect this to be a bit corrected by loop factors, say. Now, for an F and a D string, the calculation is actually very similar. Even though the D string is non-perturbative, we can still use perturbative string theory to calculate the answer. By considering boundary conditions on the world sheet to represent the D-brain. And using this technique, we actually get a similar looking answer. So it's a little bit more general. So for D-string, we can actually generalize this a bit to make it a PQ-string. So we can actually get some similar geometric expression in terms of PQ for an F-string to reconnect and break onto a D-string. Now for DD-strings, the situation is actually very different. So here we have two non-perturbative objects. So there's no way that we could use perturbative string theory to try to estimate it. The best that we could do is we could say, well, let's imagine that we have two D strings flying towards each other. As they get near each other, we might expect that some F strings will pop out of the vacuum and attach onto the D strings. And so if we get enough F strings popping out of the vacuum, then we might expect the D strings to reconnect. So this is the usual type of D string decay as the tachyon modes appear, and we look for when this tachyon forms. And so the best that we could do is try to estimate how many F strings appear, and based on the tension of all these F string pairs, try to estimate how many would be needed to reconnect the D strings. And so a very crude argument, a very crude estimate for how many F strings would appear, gives an expression like this, where there is some dependence on the relative angle and velocity. And it's actually reassuring that in this estimate, it has the expected non-perturbative answer of e to the minus 1 over g. So this is the expected type of expression that we would have for a non-perturbative process.
So is d and dd or just dd?
These are just dd. We don't expect we don't expect them to annihilate. So it's a relative angle here. Yeah. So they're at some angle.
But that means d and dd, would that not make sense?
But it depends on the angle, right? If the angle is pi, then d and
dd. Yeah.
So could you sorry, how do you get this possibility that is the extreme equation?
Yeah. So you calculate how many F strings would pop out of the vacuum to attach onto the D strings. And so then based on so you get some number of F strings, each of those F strings has some amount of tension. And so you have the total amount of tension pulling the D strings together. But they don't want to be pulled together, they're flying apart. And so by figuring out sort of a balancing equation of how much tension would be needed. So if we have two D strings, which are pretty heavy, flying towards each other, and only one light F string appears out of the vacuum, that's not enough to make them want to reconnect. The D strings will just fly through each other and keep going, and that's
well,
it.
What is totally the imaginary part of the amplitude?
Right, so the imaginary...
From that, you estimate the number of open strings...
Right, so the imaginary part of the amplitude is usually associated with attenuation, right?
Yes.
Like these non-elastic processes. So it's this type of thing that we calculate.
So you estimate the number of open strings created, and then you compute the expected tension?
Exactly. So it's this diagram I showed here, where we have these D strings flying towards each other, and then we just sort of try to balance, like in freshman physics, where you're trying to balance the tensions, and figure out how much tension would be needed to make the D strings want to reconnect.
So what is
would you run the middle of just the partition function given the length?
Yeah. So we just estimate how many modes might appear in those boundary conditions.
I just missed the sign of your answer. If the two strings come in orthogonally, you see the probability is almost one or almost zero for reconnection. It was minus one over g, but I wasn't sure which probability it was.
For the strings to reconnect.
So they almost always pass through each other and don't reconnect.
Yeah, at weak coupling, so e to the minus one over g, so the probability is almost zero for them to reconnect.
What's the
space-time dimension? Well, it's 3 plus 1 large dimensions, and then we compactify the others.
So it's really
Yeah. So whenever we're talking about cosmic strings, we usually worry about 3 plus 1s.
So why don't, I mean, as you said before, there are cases where you could have some duality between string theories and field theories and so forth, and I might have imagined in some brain-anti-brain model, which I can describe as a field theory, that this really is a topological defect string.
Absolutely. So
why don't they act like gauge theory? Why don't these strings act like gauge theory strings? They do sometimes.
Good. So actually, no. Actually, there's a beautiful actually, that's the next slide.
Oh, okay.
That's what I'm going to talk about. I was going to say there's a beautiful paper, but actually that's the next slide. So we did this estimate sort of based on the appearance of these F strings.
Okay.
This was followed up by a beautiful paper by Panani and Hashimoto, in which they did this better calculation on the world sheet of these D strings. And what was great about this paper was that it actually made precise the difference between D strings and gauge strings. And they actually showed that when you write when you have these transverse coordinates for what the D brain coordinates have to be doing when they fly through each other or they reconnect, the embedding of the D strings in space-time.
Uh-huh. Sorry, those are things you would also have for gauge theory strings.
Right. So when they worked out what the solutions of these had to be for the strings, it turns out that for D strings, there was an Fi term that had to be non-zero, whereas for the classical strings, it was zero, and there was some very small technical difference between the two. And that was the difference between the classical type of strings and the D strings. They actually, in this paper, they actually set it up so that there was actually just a very small technical difference between the two, whether it was a D string or a gauge string. So in this paper, they started out with a legitimate D brain calculation on the world volume of the D strings. And what they looked for was the probability of reconnection based on this tachyon field. to appear. So this represents the appearance of these F strings. But they have this, in their setup, they have this tachyon field, which is localized to begin with, as these D strings are far away. As they get very near, the potential gets inverted. And so this tachyon field, the wave function, expands. And so the reconnection actually corresponds to this part out here, which has sort of tunneled out. So it corresponds to the tunneling of these F strings. And so based on some estimates of this, they actually get a very similar answer to ours, computed with a completely different technique. And again, they recover this e to the minus 1 over g factor, as you would expect. So it's reassuring that these two different mechanisms to estimate this D string reconnection agree to lowest order.
But the F strings are small angle. They are small.
Yeah, I think, yeah, they do make a small angle approximation. Yeah. Yeah.
So the conclusion they're studying was this small technical difference makes a big difference in the answer in the end?
Yeah. What happens is that for classical strings, the strings can fly towards each other, and there is a classical, when you look at the solutions, there is a classical trajectory by which the strings can reconnect.
Right.
So it will do this with probability 1. For D strings, turning on this Fi parameter removes this classical solution, and so the only way that they can reconnect is by a tunneling process. And so this is why it's a probabilistic answer, because it has to tunnel through, and there's some probability of reconnecting. There is no classical solution which would let it do this.
And this was their choice to turn on this Fi term, or it can't be zero?
It's your choice, and depending on that choice, it will be a gauge string, which will always reconnect, or it will be a D string, which there's some probability to reconnect or not. But it was entirely, it was this parameter produced the existence or non-existence of this solution.
But for some reason, if this parameter is zero, then you would never call it a D string. It's something that's fundamentally gauge theory.
Yes, that was true. So another difference that cosmic superstrings would have is that in superstring theory, of course, we have extra dimensions. And even though they may not be obviously present, of course, the string wave function is aware of them. And so we would expect this to have some sort of effect on the probability of reconnection. Now, the simplest thing that we could do is just to say, OK, these dimensions are very small, so the wave function is spread out. And we all know that we can estimate this by just taking the usual probability and just sort of adding a 1 over the compact volume. So this is when we only include the zero modes. We just get a simple factor out front. But we can then try to be a little bit more sophisticated. And we can say, well, what if it's not like literally confined, because it's a small space? But what if the wave function is effectively confined, because we have some sort of warping potential, as we usually do in these string cosmology models, where the wave function will sit at the bottom, and so there's an effective width. And so I should be able to compute what effect this would have here. And as sort of a crude estimate, we can say, well, I know that if this was a simple harmonic oscillator, I know that it's just a Gaussian and it will have some width. And so I can say that the wave function sort of has this size. For a string, it's not just the zero mode. There's higher modes moving on the string. But we should be able to do the same thing. And so we can get a typical expression for the size of the string just by adding up all the modes. The more precise way to do this is, of course, all this information is already encoded in the effective action. This is why we usually don't have to do technical string theory calculation. This has already been done for us when people have produced this effective action for space-time. And so this shows how this field, this winding mode, couples to the background fields. So all we would have to do is plug in our dilaton or metric or what have you and see how this would affect the answer. And so so this is what I've done in this paper a few years ago. And sticking in typical values for these cosmological backgrounds that people study, like KK, LMMT, you can actually see exactly this type of suppression that you get from the background. And so there's a very precise recipe. And the great thing about this is you now have sort of a signature. Depending on your background, you see that this influences the probability of reconnection very precisely. So there's a very simple prescription for seeing how the background would affect the reconnection probability. Yeah, so recall that the way that we computed the reconnection probabilities was to use these tachyon fields, which are now in the spectrum because we did the GSO reversal. And so these winding strings actually represent wound modes of the tachyon field. And so if we want to see how this would be influenced by turning on some background.
Can you use this for like KK?
Yeah. So I did exactly that. So in the paper.
But these tachyons don't exist.
So it's actually a bit of a misnomer. It's only a tachyon if you haven't wound it. So it's a tachyon if you just in its most natural state. But once you add a winding mode to the tachyon, it actually is stable. It's not a tachyon anymore.
So which string do you have it mostly?
In this one, it's 0B.
0B.
It's 0B.
And then can you do KK against T?
So the background fields in type 0B are very similar to type 2B. I think it's just that, what is it? There's two RR fields or something. This is doubled because it's because the GSO reversal, it's removing it from one sector and sticking in the next.
So the string you're considering may be stable because of the winding.
Right.
But the theory itself has tachyon.
Yes, the theory itself does, but
So the theory itself is unstable.
Yes, but just to estimate how the background fields would influence the probability of reconnection, there's no issues about instabilities or anything. That doesn't appear anywhere. This was just a trick that I played just to see how the background would influence the reconnection. But anyway, so the punchline here is that there is a precise correspondence between the background in which this reconnection is taking place and the probability of reconnection. Now, as I mentioned briefly earlier, not only do these strings wiggle around, but they also emit radiation. And so I talked a little bit about how the strings emit radiation just as they're wiggling through space, but they also should do this as they reconnect, not just afterwards when they form a kink, but the reconnection process itself should be expected to produce this radiation. And this would actually seem to be a much more difficult technical problem because we now have one more vertex operator to worry about, and there's all these correlations between the two. But intuitively, you know that this reconnection probability shouldn't really be affected by any sort of radiation process. You could sort of think of the radiation process as some sort of perturbation on a background process. These strings are so big and the energy scales involved are so big that we would expect it to be basically the same, and then the radiation process is just a small perturbation. And so what you can do is you can actually work out the reconnection process trajectory, so what the strings are doing while it's reconnecting. And you can actually explicitly figure out what this trajectory is. So this is actually the exact trajectory for the strings to reconnect. And then you can just feed this in to the equations for reconnection. And it's actually kind of cool because this allows you to visualize the reconnection process for the first time. So from the world sheet perspective, so this is the vertex operator inserted one straight string, and this is the vertex operator insertion for the other straight string. And then at infinity is the final reconnected kinked string. So we see here is a perfectly smooth process, as we would expect in string theory. But when we look at this embedded in space-time, so we see the two straight strings. So I've projected out this third axis. So this is time. We see that the two strings start out like this. And it's a smooth process, but only because of the way that it's embedded in space-time does it look like there's a sharp reconnection discontinuity. But as far as the string is concerned, things are perfectly smooth.
Do you have one complex
coordinate
for
T
version?
No, it's just.
So you say it's just one world sheet?
Just one world sheet. This is just the world sheet that you would use for two straight strings.
Sometimes it may have two strings, but embedded in space time, it's actually just one world sheet.
When you calculate reconnections, so vertex operators, remember, you have these asymptotic strings coming out.
So in the asymptotic region, you have two strings.
So I have two strings coming in, and then at infinity, it's the kinked guy going out.
Yeah, so at a given time slice, you have two disconnected strings.
At late times is one string, because it's winding on.
Yeah.
Okay, so then in the far past, you have two disconnected strings.
Yes, in the far past, there's two disconnect strings. In the far future, it's one reconnected kink string.
But
But when we embed it in space-time, this is why to us it appears like there's this reconnection discontinuity. But from the string's perspective, everything is perfectly smooth. So we can use this background process to do all sorts of interesting calculations for say, the radiation emitted during this reconnection process. And you can actually get explicit answers for how this radiation is going to be emitted during the reconnection process. So here's the same diagram that I drew before. So I have these two straight strings coming in and reconnecting at some angle. So after they reconnect into the kink form, you can actually see that there's actually a burst of radiation emitted in those directions, which is sort of intuitively what you would expect. And then you can even see, relative to the plane of reconnection, that most of the radiation wants to pretty much stay in that plane unless the strings are reconnecting at nearly the speed of light. Then the radiation is sort of thrown out of the plane of reconnection. But you see that it's not linear. It has to be going very, very fast for it to be thrown any sizable amount out of the plane. So now we have these explicit expressions for the radiation emitted from the reconnection. And we can use this to get the waveform. And so we can go ahead and run cosmological simulations to see if there's any way that LIGO might be able to detect this. And so we have codes running right now. So this is work I'm doing with Xavier Siemens, who's a member of the LIGO team. And the results are actually kind of exciting. We see that if G mu is actually, so we already know that it can't be around here. This has already been ruled out. But if it's actually anywhere near this, we see the probability of advanced LIGO detecting it is actually almost certainty. So this is the probability of detecting it in 1 year of data. So we see that even though it was unlikely for us to detect the radiation just from the usual wiggling, the probability of detecting the radiation from the reconnection is actually much greater. So because of this violent process of the reconnection, it actually makes more radiation. It's a much stronger signal. So this is the preliminary result, so we're doing more refined calculations right now. But this is actually very exciting that we might be able to see this radiation in the reconnection. So I've talked a lot about how different these different probabilities of reconnection are, and how the gauge theory cosmic string reconnection is almost one, and for the cosmic superstrings, it depends on all these different parameters and the coupling constant and the backgrounds and so forth. So if it's so important to see which type of cosmic string it is, how would we actually go out and measure this in the real world?
That plot you just showed about what the probability of LIGO detecting something, does that assume that somewhere you've got some density of strings and some probability of reconnection?
Right.
What value of P did you
see? So for that, we actually used a P of 1.
So that's for gauge theory strings.
This is the preliminary stuff that he was doing just to make it as simple as possible. We use P of 1, but right now we're trying to do more sophisticated things.
Roughly scaled.
Exactly. So overall, it should be pulled down. Exactly.
Oh, it's nice to move the gauge theory strings, too.
Yeah. That would be fun to find also. So if it's so important what this P is, because this will tell us which type of cosmic string it is, how would we actually go out and figure out what P is? So there's actually three ways. So the first is the kink angles. So if we were to find a cosmic string, and we could sort of map it from gravitational lensing, the most obvious way, we would find probably that it looks something like this. And this is because as the cosmic string has lived its life, it's probably undergone many reconnections. And after doing each reconnection, it will form a kink like this, and so we can just measure these relative kink angles. And so we can see how likely it is to reconnect at each of these various angles. And so this will give us some information about what P is. If the angles are pretty much uniformly distributed, this would tell us that P really doesn't depend on theta at all, and so it's probably a gauge string. But if there was a definite preference towards anti-correlated strings, so if they almost always reconnected when the strings were oppositely oriented, so it would produce a very acute angle, that would strongly imply that it was a cosmic superstring.
How do you measure the data?
Well, if you actually were able to see the cosmic string in the sky and map it out.
So
this is direct. This is direct. Yeah, right. Yeah. This is the most direct.
Other than direct.
Yeah, so there's two more. So sort of indirect way is that if the probability of reconnection was lower, you would expect the strings don't cut each other up as much. They don't interact. And so you would expect more of the cosmic strings to be there in the sky. And so it would produce a much stronger signal. There's more cosmic strings there to emit gravitational radiation. And so I showed you this graph earlier, and I said it was a bit pessimistic for how much radiation that we would expect to see. But that was assuming sort of a gauge model where P was 1. But if you relax this assumption and you say that maybe P wasn't 1, maybe it was like on the order of 1/100th, then you see the signal is much, much stronger, and the probability is almost unity for us to detect a cosmic superstring. If the lower P is, the less the cosmic strings interact, there's more of them, the more radiation emits, the more likely it is that we would see this. So this is good news for wanting to detect a cosmic superstring. There should be a lot more out there for us to detect. And then finally, if we didn't just detect one cosmic string, if we were able to detect many cosmic strings, because there's more of them, we would expect them to be closer together. And so by measuring sort of the average distance between the cosmic strings, that should also try to give some sort of estimate for how much cosmic string was there, independent of the gravitational radiation that it was emitting. Now, the final thing I want to talk about is that cosmic superstrings, as I mentioned, can form some very unusual type of networks and do some things that the usual gauge theory cosmic strings can't do. So one thing is that because of these extra dimensions, not only is the probability of reconnection influenced, but the cosmic string itself could actually wind around these extra dimensions if topology so allowed. And so because of this winding, there should be a little bit of extra energy, and so you would get these sort of beads that they've called, they've given the name psych loops, like cycle that they wrap, and then they're loops. This also has to do with the fact that it's, you know, this guy was Greek, like Cyclops. I don't know.
Why do they need me? Why don't these?
You would expect them to sort of spread out. That's exactly what I told them, and yeah, they couldn't explain to me why. They expected it to be very localized, and I still don't understand why. I would expect, yeah, because there's no energetic reason why it would only wind at this one localized point. I completely agree. But they claim that you would expect to see these beads. They would be very tiny, but because you would have this extra little bump in the energy, so they claim, you would expect that the dynamics of the string to be different. It would wiggle differently. So you can imagine like a string wiggling with a little mass attached to it. And so it would affect the way that the string would wiggle, and so it would affect the gravitational radiation pattern. So I think this is their scenario, that you would give a different type of radiation.
I mean, if you just do it by three-dimensional analysis, these things would have to be the equivalent of, you know, many kilometers of string in mass before you notice any difference, because by the time you go along the distance, that seems wrong.
Yeah, no, I...
Right, kilometers worth of mass of strings is a lot of mass. So it's probably a lot easier to get beats by just having the string accidentally get a
buffer. Well, I think it's not just that it would do one. I think that it would accumulate many of them or something. And so as you integrate this over long distance.
It's probably a lot easier to imagine the string accidentally pass through a black hole, and that would give you really big beat.
There's also the possibility that if you have these D brains there, and the D brains were wrapping around these compact cycles, you would allow these F and D strings to actually attach to the end, and so these D brains would act as sort of nodes. So you would get this nodal network. And there's actually some, this was already studied already in gauge type of models. And so there's already some work that's been done on this, but more explicit work can be done because we know more properties about D brains and such. And then finally, as I mentioned, cosmic superstrings should be able to produce these so-called p-cute networks. And these are especially attractive because you would think that this seems like a very unique signature of string theory, because of the way that the tensions add together. If we were lucky enough to actually find this network and actually explicitly see it in the sky, and through gravitational lensing measure the tensions, then we would just be able to check, as a yes or no question, do these tensions all add up according to the formula given by the PQ theory? And this was actually one thing I studied. How unique really is this? Is there some way to mimic this from field theory? And so what we want to know is, is there a way that we could get all the tensions to add up, according to this formula, from some sort of field theory, so that if we were able to see this, would we know that this was a unique signature of string theory? And there's actually a really good reason to think that we would be able to get this from field theory, and that's because in certain supersymmetric theories, when the R-symmetry gets enhanced, it actually allows you to have an FI term, which actually gives you three linearly independent charge numbers. So not only should we be able to get PQ strings, we should be able to have PQR strings. So we would naively be able to get actually a new type of cosmic string network. So if we could get this, this would actually be a unique signature of field theory, which we haven't been able to get so far from string theory. But it turns out that when you actually go through the equations and you look for solutions to these BPS equations, the system actually prevents you from ever forming one of these PQ networks. It allows you to have a P string, and it allows you to have a Q string, and even an R string. So there's a third type. But you can never actually turn on two at the same time, it turns out. If you want to keep this BPS spectrum, this square root formula that we were trying to get. And so it's kind of funny that in the last step, the system will actually prevent you from doing this. And so it seems that so far, the PQ spectrum, the PQ network, actually does seem to be a unique signature of string theory. The only caveat is that, of course, I was only looking at the BPS solutions, the lowest energy states. And so it's possible that the generic solutions might allow you to have such a PQ network. And the energy levels are only slightly above the BPS ones. So experimentally, it would be indistinguishable. And then finally, I want to mention some work that I'm doing right now with Savdeep Sethi at the University of Chicago. And so far, all of the cosmic superstrings I've been talking about have been in the type 2 theory. It's actually much more phenomenologically interesting to talk about cosmic superstrings in the heterotic theory. And it was actually precisely this theory that Witten originally studied and then discarded because the heterotic cosmic strings were unstable. But when I talk about heterotic strings now, I actually mean the strongly coupled heterotic strings. So this comes from M theory. And there's actually three different ways that we could do this. We could either start with an M2 brain and take one of those dimensions to be wrapped along this interval that we usually talk about in M theory. Or I could take M5 brains and have one of those dimensions wrapped on the same interval. Or I could have some of these dimensions all wrapped in the Calabi-Yau dimensions. And so when you actually think about these three different possibilities, there's actually only one of these possibilities that it's still viable, and that's the one I just mentioned. When four of these dimensions, the M5 brains, are wrapped around Calabi-Yau dimensions, this actually allows a much lower tension, and it allows a stable heterotic cosmic superstring. And so right now, we're working out some of the phenomenology of this, and this is especially interesting because right now, people are making much more precise measurements of CMB power spectrum. And it's actually become a little bit challenging to produce inflationary models from inflation because of the so-called life bound. Because there's actually a relationship between the size of extra dimensions and the amount of this tensor radiation that people are going to go out and measure. And so it turns out with heterotic cosmic strings, this is actually a very easy bound to avoid. And it's actually difficult to avoid this in the type 2 thing, in the type 2 theory. And so this is actually sort of an appealing direction to be going into. And so Savdeep and I hope to be able to make some very precise predictions with this. So finally, to conclude, I hope that I've explained to you that conventional and superstring cosmic strings could plausibly exist. So I'm not saying that they're guaranteed to exist, but at least there's no reason to already rule them out completely. There's actually a huge difference between the two different types, in the reconnection values and in the gravitational radiation type of signatures. Now, the next thing that we need to do is to compute more refined calculations of this probability of reconnection. So this could be done either like the background techniques that I talked about or from computing higher loop effects. There's also this inverse problem that actually people right here, right now, have been working on. And so this problem is if we actually went out and detected cosmic strings, trying to interpret some of the fundamental parameters such as the string tension and like string coupling constant from this. And then finally...
Okay, I think I should point out a typo.
Yeah?
Florian is the first name of Dubov.
Ah.
that
is a strange typo, actually. For some reason, I thought that in my mind they were two different people. But Polchinski is not the middle name.
Right. there are three authors.
Yeah, okay. I think there were three different people working on it for some reason. Yeah, I apologize. Yeah. So, and then finally, I think the most important thing to do is to actually go out and find one. So that's all. Thank you. This was the work that David Tong did, I think. Does that Annie? I think I've seen exactly these type of. Yeah. Yeah.
So usually, gravitational radiation from subs is stronger than from kinks.
Yeah.
What is it that makes the inverse from kinks so strong in this case?
So the reason that it's so much stronger is because when you look for a saddle point, so when you have this expression for the gravitational radiation, you look for a saddle point or at least a discontinuity, because then the path that's where the integral for the radiation would be strongest. So for the cusp, you actually do get a saddle point. So for both the left and the right moving modes, there's a saddle point at the same place. So they add together. For the kink, it turns out that one of them, say the left, has a saddle point, and the other one doesn't have a saddle point, but it has a discontinuity at that same place. So it's not as strong, but at least there is some non-zero contribution. So for the reconnection process, when you plug in the trajectory for the cosmic strings to reconnect, even though they reconnect into this kink-looking form, mathematically, there's still a double saddle point. So it sort of has the same mathematical form as a cusp, which was not what I expected. I expected it to sort of look kink-like, but it turns out there is a double saddle point at the same place during the reconnection. So in that sense, it's stronger than you would expect for the reconnection.
Any other questions?
Thank you.